Good morning, everybody. My name is Enrique Seoane, and this research was directed by Rosa Rodriguez Monguio. Today, we'll talk about the impact of the Waxman-Hatch Act of 1984 on generic competition in the US pharmaceutical market. This one was one of the main regulations affecting pharmaceuticals in the US, and from that moment, we will see how this regulation allowed the increase in the utilization of generics and approval of new generics coming to the market, but at the same time, we will see how this regulation didn't allow to curb the increases in pharmaceutical expenditures in the US. We will go through the short introduction, the objectives, methods, results, and we will end with some conclusions. This chart represents generic drugs as a percentage of outpatient prescriptions dispensed in the US between 1984 and 2008. And 1984 was the year when the Waxman-Hatch Act was approved. And as you see in the chart, in 1984, only 19% of all the outpatient prescriptions in the US were dispensed as generic. In 2008, that percentage increased to 69% of all prescriptions. As you see, we can see in this chart the impact of generics in the US market. But in a speed of increase of the utilization of generic drugs, we'll see here how the increase in prescription drug expenditures continue. In the year 1984, we spend in the US around $20 billion in pharmaceuticals, outpatient pharmaceuticals, and in 2008, we spent more than 10 times this amount, $235 billion. Therefore, in a speed of the increase in generic utilization, we see here also how pharmaceutical expenditures continue to increase in the US. There are many regulations approved in the past 26 years that affected generic competition. Here is a list of the most relevant. The first one is the Orphan Drug of 1983 that established the orphan drug exclusivity. In 1984, it was approved the Waxman-Hatch Act. In 1995, the Uruguay Round Agreements Act that established a patent term of 20 years from filing and established also a provisional patent system that affected also pharmaceuticals. And in 1997, we have FDEMA that included the pediatric exclusivity that applies to specific pharmaceuticals. All these regulations affected intellectual property in one or other way. Maybe the most relevant and important of all the regulations is the Waxman-Hatch Act of 1984. This is the name of the sponsor, Waxman and Hatch. The name of the regulation is Drug Policy, Competition and Patent Term Restoration Act of 1984. And we see here in this title the two main issues, increased competition and also increased the patent life of the pharmaceuticals. This regulation contains a set of complex regulations, including brands and generic drug approvals, and also the patent and exclusivity life of pharmaceuticals. The main provisions of this act include the abbreviated new drug application, ANDA, that is a process for generic drugs that didn't exist before of this regulation. No patent holders can use patented drugs for activities related to ANDA submission, what is called the BOLAR provision. That also was something new that didn't exist in the regulation in the US before. ANDA requires certification of invalidity of no infringement of the patents that maybe the brand companies may have listed for some specific drugs. And includes also 180 days exclusivity to generic companies that first submit a substantially complete ANDA and successfully defend patent infringement suits filed by patent holders. Also, among the main provisions of this act, there are the market exclusivity beyond the patent for certain drugs and new drug applications, including 5 years for new molecular entities and 3 years for substantial changes in the labeling of a previously approved drug. And there is also the extension of the statutory term of patents by restoring part of the time spent by a company fulfilling the FDA requirements for approval. The objectives of our study were to assess the effect of the One-Man-Hatch Act on generic entry of drug products approved by the FDA after the implementation of the Act. The sources of data were the approved drug products with therapeutic equivalent evaluations, what is called the Orange Book, versions 1980 to 2009. There is also a database that includes all the approvals in the US, or most of the approvals of drugs in the US, that is the drugs at FDA database. And also, all these databases were updated up to February 2009. Related with the methods, we did a comparison of generic entry for drugs without patent protections that were approved pre and post implementation of the Waxman-Hatch Act. The effective patent life of the drugs was conservatively set at 14 years counted from NDA approval. Therefore, after 14 years, we considered that it was feasible the entry of generic products in the market for this specific product. We used descriptive statistics for all variables included in the analysis. We evaluated differences in proportions using chi-square and Fisher-Schacht tests. And we evaluated differences between groups means using t-tests. We had a sample of 2,190 products that were listed by the FDA. 15 were tentatively approved and were excluded, leaving a sample of 2,175 products. Of those, 1,324 were approved before the Waxman-Hatch Act, and 851 were approved after the Waxman-Hatch Act. We see here in this chart, on the left we see the pre-Waxman-Hatch Act, and in the right, we see the post-Waxman-Hatch Act. As we see in the pre-Waxman-Hatch Act, approximately 270 drugs were in the market more than 14 years, therefore they could have generic competition. And in the post-Waxman-Hatch Act, we had a sample of 420 drugs that were in the market more than 14 years. Evaluating specifically this sample of products that could have generic competition, we see how in the pre-Waxman-Hatch, that is on the left of this chart, 24 products have generic competition pre-Waxman-Hatch Act, representing 8.9% of the products that could have generic competition. In the right, we have the situation for the post-Waxman-Hatch Act, and as we see here, they were 174 products, representing 41.4% of all the products that could have generic competition that have actually generic competition. The difference between pre and post Waxman-Hatch Act was statistically significant. We also evaluated the number of generic competitors for the products with more than 14 years in the market and that had generic competition. And as we see here, in the pre-Waxman-Hatch Act, it was an average of 1.9 generic companies marketing a generic product for each brand product available in the market. And as we see in the right, post-Waxman-Hatch Act, the number of generic competitors in the market increased dramatically to 12.5 generic products per brand product. This difference was also statistically significant. The conclusions are that the Waxman-Hatch Act was successful in encouraging generic competition. But we have also increasing utilization and higher prices of new drugs that upset the savings derived from the increase in generic utilization. After the Waxman-Hatch Act, the proportion of drug products with generic competition and the number of generic competitors per drug product increased significantly. The increase in competition occurred in spite of increasing patent and exclusivity restrictions to generic entry established by the own Waxman-Hatch Act and other patent and FDA regulations. There are other factors that also help to explain the increase in generic competition in the study period. First, the implementation of cost containment measures in the healthcare system, the enforcement by the FDA of strict generic bioequivalence and quality standards that also increase the perception of quality of generic products available in the market, and the development of the generic industry. We have right now very large multinational generic companies that weren't there a few years ago prior to the implementation of the Waxman-Hatch Act. Some limitations related with the database, basically. Some products approved by the FDA in the study period are not listed in the FDA databases. And also, we use in the study 40 years as the time of the drug in the market that will allow the entry of generic competitors. And this is a conservative estimate. We don't have any relationships to disclose. And that's it. Thank you.
This is the last of seven sessions that were organized by a combination of the APHA Pharmaceuticals Interest and Working Group and the Drug Policy and Pharmacy Services Group, which come out of International Health and Medical Care. And we're working across five different sections this particular year and one forum. So we weren't able to schedule everything so that there wasn't some conflict because of the different sections being involved. And there were also some posters. And I've passed around a sign-up sheet, which maybe I'll pass around again because there are some new people. It's for email. It's extremely light traffic. We really we send out things that other people send to us. We're not trying to duplicate other sources. We'll recommend other sources. And we do try to organize sessions at the conference. So can I, and my apologies again for being late to all of you, and thank you, Anno, for getting things going. Appreciate that. People have questions? Yes?
Question, comment for Mr. Peel. I'm the person who released the Zyprexa documents that resulted in the conviction.
Okay.
And I almost went to jail, and I had to pay Libby $100,000 to prevent them. The judge in Victor called me for having released the documents. So criminal penalties are viable, but they're only applied against people who try to get the truth out. With respect to your suggestion about private tort actions, I'm a consultant in the rotten suicide cases. Mm-hmm. It's not going to work, because we can't get the off-label marketing in unless we can specifically show that it impacted on the physician's prescribing in the case. And no physician will ever admit they were in any way ever influenced by a pharmaceutical company any which way loose. And then third, with respect to the information sources and relying on physicians, Kate Dickerson had a good cartoon in her talk, the surgical suite, and they say, well, let's try this and see what happens. That is what physicians do. There is no data, there's no evidence except for minoxidil that any of the off-label uses have ever worked based on randomized controlled trials. So that's just factually unsupported.
Yeah. What I would say with regard to your second point about the liability is that what I envisioned is that through statute, you would put the liability on the company and say that you wouldn't have to show that the physician was influenced. You just have to show that you promoted it, that the use was not approved by the FDA, and therefore the standard that you, as the manufacturer, would be held to, regardless of where the physician got the information, the standard would be much easier for the plaintiff. I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Well, I'm just telling you that the case law goes the other way.
Right.
If you, and I can't see a judge saying, yes, you marketed it, but there's no evidence this doctor saw that marketing. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there's no evidence, there's no causal nexus between your marketing and the physician. That's why all the cases don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
I can't see a judge, they're going to throw that as unconstitutional infringement of the First Amendment rights of the companies to do things that don't adversely impact on the physician's practice.
Well, we can.
Yeah. But that's what's going on there.
Yeah.
Yes.
A question, Dr. Fila. Oh, sorry that you have two questions in a row. But do you think that perhaps, I look at the sales rep as the weakest link, or the strongest link from the point of view of the company, and that they're not really accountable. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so I say, do you think certification or licensing would help address that?
There is a movement that way.
There is.
Probably aware. Yeah.
Well, I'm not aware. No, I've been out of the patient care area for a while. Go ahead.
Yeah. To have some kind of certification, and presumably it would have an ethics and a good practices component and so forth. I guess what
well,
I would...
Not that, but, you know, basically, I was on a state licensing board in New York 9 years, but basically to take them out of practice when it can, you know, because they, example, Xopenex, when I practiced in the hospital, when I first came on, the dosages were exceeded by the physicians based upon the sales reps' affirmations that it was okay. Mm-hmm. The company didn't even back up, but the sales rep was the only contact that the physicians had. It's almost like a doctor's office, it looks like they're dealing drugs. They get in the corner and start talking in whispers. And that's where the information comes from, the drug rep. As far as I know, there's no real certification or credentialing of a drug rep. They're hired sent out.
Yeah. My understanding is that they are, by the companies, very well trained, that they do get some science training in addition to marketing training. I do know that there is a movement to set up some kind of institutional, you know, cross-company certification. What I would wonder, though, is that the off-label promotions are so profitable that it would be difficult to stop them. On the other hand, perhaps they could be done with more integrity so that the sales rep is more aware of when they're based on real data and true publication. So I think it could get at part of the problem.
And there has been legislation passed just in the Washington, D.C. area. It's a number of state legislators that are working on issues to have them certified in that area or have them meet minimum kinds of qualifications in terms of education, not necessarily specific to pharmaceuticals, but so you don't just get good-looking blondes who are able to sell. Did you have a second question?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, just following up on this, I mean, I don't see why do we have to allow at all the promotion off-label by the drug company? I mean, it's secure. Yeah, there are other references, because also this is, and again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a doctor, but it's the same people that promote, I mean, the drug reps are coming to you and telling you, well, you know, these opinion leaders are the ones who are using them. Mm-hmm. They happen to be, of course, the people who are getting hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. So if Dr. Smith is doing it, you're safe. Mm-hmm. You're okay. I mean, mm-hmm. you know who's Dr. Smith. So I don't see any scenario where, because you already quoted, there are many quasi-governmental agencies that are producing information, and there are some journals still, not a lot, but some scientific journals that do produce original research, not industry sponsored. So why do we have to allow at all the promotion of off-label?
Mm-hmm. The issue is a legal one that the D.C. court addressed, and they said it's a First Amendment issue, that the drug rep is you know, a citizen, that they have a right to open their mouth and say whatever they want, and that the government has the only very narrow grounds for limiting what they can and can't say, so that if the government feels that it's specifically false and misleading, yes, they can prevent it or sanction it if it happens. But beyond that, the court saw it as a constitutional issue of free speech.
But isn't, by definition, misleading or false based on the fact that the FDA didn't approve that? So they're saying that this is useful based on information that is not documented anywhere without any kind of support. And I guess that, in that sense, if you cannot prove it, I mean.
Well, the part is proving what was and wasn't said. If it is entirely truthful, this has not been submitted or reviewed by the FDA. There are studies that go both ways on this. Here's a pile of pro, here's a pile of con. Then that's okay. The problem is you don't know what went on and what the sales rep actually said. So it's awfully hard to prove that they were false and misleading.
That's the person said.
I mean, you may have
only one case where off label actually afterwards was the Rogaine case, but it's based on history.
But you may have some thoughts on how do you prove that what the sales rep said wasn't
true? There was one honest sales rep who whistled, David Frank. Mm-hmm. There were 3,000 sales reps who were doing the same thing he was doing, who didn't say anything. He came forward, he was the Kate Tamlin case. He also tape recorded his marketing instructions. Mm-hmm. Now, Pfizer destroyed all their tapes. All the drug companies don't work with written documents. They all have voicemail systems, which they destroyed. So that it's after the litigation starts, they destroy mm-hmm. the evidence. Mm-hmm. And no one, so that's via the evidence.
So it's very hard to say, what happened in the doctor's office? Was it a truthful conversation or was it not? And yeah, if you tape recordings of the conversations, then that would make life a lot easier, but usually you don't.
Just a question. You mentioned the increase in expenditure from the generic in 2004. Do you have a breakdown between generics and non-generics as a percentage? What was in 1980 and what was in 2004 to see what was the impact of generics?
Yes, there are. The data is for generics, what is called branded generics, or probably have a brand, sell as a brand, as sold as a brand, but actually have generics and branded products. And the data is available for both number of prescriptions and also for overall expenditures.
But as a percentage?
As a percentage?
The expenditure of generic and brand?
Yes. The data is available for both. For
you remember what is?
Yes, it's around, for every single year, the percentage of money that goes to real generics is around 10 to 12%. Most of the increase in expenditures is coming from the branded products.
Yeah.
And what is happening is we are having a smaller percentage of the market going to the brand product, but because of increases in prices, we are seeing this constant increase in expenditures. Therefore, per se, the increase in the use of generics is not a solution. We have also to try to control in some way what happened with this 25-30% of the products is where we have the real cost.
As an aside, I sent out a group of students in a class this January to investigate attitudes about generics with four audience groups. This is in New Orleans. Pharmacists in the pharmacies, and medical school students, we paid them all to come to lunch, and doctors, who are much harder to find, get them on the telephone, and just the public. They had a very fast questionnaire they did with, 100 and some people. And what was interesting is at the pharmacy level, because the retail system is making so much more money on the generics, with it could be Walgreens brand, they were all doing substitution whenever, and they've been instructed to do that, and so they substitute all the time. The doctors weren't quite so sure generics were better, or as good, I should say. The medical school students also were not so sure, but were very amenable to education. They were more interested in learning more about it. And 65% of the people on the street thought that brand names were better than generics. They just figured that was for poorer people. Let you know, there was this, it's not so good, the best people get brand names. And So there was a real public education issue about them. But, and they were, and the profits were much better at the retail level, which is why they're pushing.
Did you have a chance to look at what, if there was any impact related to the Waxman-Hatch Act, the reformulation, if the reformulations as a percentage of new?
We have the data about between differentiating between new molecular entities and NDAs or approvals of new indications, but we didn't present that here. But we have this data.
Yes.
How are the fines determined for cases where companies are found guilty of off-label promotion that's beyond the gray zone?
This gentleman may be able to help chime in, but generally prosecutors will come in and figure out what the absolute maximum is. And usually the fines are, the statutes will describe them as a set amount for the violation in general, and then for each transaction there's an amount. So if you can show every time the drug was prescribed that's a violation, you can usually get well into the multi-billions of dollars, and then they'll negotiate it back down. And it is, I guess, somewhat arbitrary, depends on how good the negotiators are for the drug company and for the prosecutor, where in there they get. And also how egregious it is, how afraid they are if it actually goes to trial. There isn't really a set formula to it beyond that.
One thing I just want to mention, the Neurontin case, one of the unique things about that, too, is it established, I can't remember the dollar figure, but it's a very large an education grant that's met. Managed by state attorneys general, and so they're sending out their funding programs through different non-biased, evidence-based organizations to actually educate both consumers and prescribers about drug relative efficacy of drugs, too. So that's the thing where they had sort of the punitive effect of that massive fine, but they're also trying to sort of counter the effect of these types of marketing behaviors as well through education.
Sid?
Are there effective incentives for whistleblowers? Could there be more effective incentives for whistleblowers?
There probably could be more effective incentives. The biggest incentive is under the QI-TAM statute of false claims. You get to keep a portion of the recovery, and that can be quite a lot of money. There are legal protections saying that you cannot be fired for being a whistleblower, although it's often easy for companies to get around that. But that the biggest incentive there is to get a piece of the recovery. Certainly there could be better protections because you risk a lot when you put yourself out that way, and you don't know that you're going to win. You don't know the case is going to succeed.
And did I misunderstand, or did you not say you paid a $100,000 fine yourself?
Yeah, I wasn't a whistleblower. I was an expert witness.
Ah.
So I had the documents, and I released the documents. The judge had four times refused to release the documents based on motions by the plaintiff attorneys and others. Those documents were the basis of their criminal conviction and their $1.4 billion fine. But more importantly, they had off-labeled the market with the drug. Demented patients, and they knew that there was a doubling of mortality in that patient population. They also knew. Now, the FDA knew all this. The FDA also had all this data and had it covered up. Same as Vyalev's, which I also did that case. The FDA had all this data. The companies have the FDA agrees with the companies to keep the data secret. And by the way, as a result of this Neurontin pleading and all these guilty pleas, all the documents are still sealed. So this is as if a bank robber admitted to robbing banks but said, my technique for robbing banks is a trade secret. So I will pay you I will pay you 1% of my earnings from robbing banks. I'm not going to go to jail, but you have to keep my techniques secret. And by the way, the Pfizer was the Neurontin pleader. It was a 5-year corporate accountability agreement, which was signed by their general counsel every year. From 2004 to 2009. This $2.4 billion which fine was for the same type of conduct for 13 drugs and the same argument, the same solution is in place. There's another corporate accountability agreement No one went to jail for filing false reports to the inspector general. And the inspector general never did anything about, obviously they filed false reports for 5 years because they just paid $2.4 billion for the same conduct, and it was supposed to be under a corporate accountability agreement, which was specifically supposed to be signed off by Kindler, who's the president, CEO. And, you know, like Sarbanes-Oxley, you're supposed to take seriously those reporting. The CEO has to sign them because they're up for criminal complaints if there's something wrong. Never, never applied to pharmaceutical companies. Never applied.
I have a comment. We are discussing the role of the FDA, the role of the industry, and also the role of the physician of labor use. But we have here also the pharmacy perspective. Maybe you can bring some issues, what you are doing with NTM, trying to control this problem. Because basically, first, the payers can decide they don't pay anymore for off-label uses. And this is happening more and more. And I know that the pharmacies are also having some specific activities trying to control this type of label usage.
Oh, as part of this project, I did not deal at all with off-label use.
You've got a problem there, though, because if they absolutely refuse to pay for off-label use, there's not legitimate off-label uses. So.
Normally, it's an issue of very costly pharmaceuticals where the payers are saying, we don't want to pay for this medication. And they have a lot of restrictions established by PBMs. And the pharmacies are also doing a very nice job controlling this type of uses. I think we need this last line of defense before the patient uses the prescription, because doctors definitely are prescribing all these medications, and somebody has to control in the end either the payment or either the dispensing of this medication.
I'm an internal medicine physician, and to restrict completely off-label use isn't a good way to practice medicine either. Because if you start looking at the label for aspirin,
right.
I mean, aspirin is used all kinds of ways that's not in a label, and aspirin is never subjected to clinical trials in the way that current drug approvals are, and the requirements for drug approvals are very strict, which is appropriate, but then it makes, you know, like the comment was made, it makes the indication very narrow. But it is a difficult area, and I have worked in the pharmaceutical industry before and across all of the medical roles, including the medical affairs role, which is supposed to provide the oversight for how the medical information is communicated accurately outside of the pharmaceutical company to the medical community. But on the other side, the sales reps are paid directly based on the number of prescriptions that their market writes. So each, and that the personality that goes into sales is, everyone can imagine their risk-taking personality. So they decide how far they will push the envelope individually, and then each company has a philosophy for how much risk they're going to allow their group to take. And one of the questions that I had with the egregiousness of some of the off-label promoting activities, is there any connection with the advent of direct-to-consumer advertising? Because I don't support direct-to-consumer advertising. I didn't like it when I was in practice. I didn't like it when I was in industry. I think it's one of the things that's made industry look terrible to the medical community and to the public. But I was just curious if there's any connection there.
I don't know if anyone has studied that. Certainly there's a simultaneous growth in these settlements and DTC advertising. But I'm not aware that anyone has looked directly at how it works as an incentive for more of this.
Well, it's clearly very effective in getting sales up. They know that I want to just take a question here because you haven't said anything.
I just had a comment in regards to your comments. I work for the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and we're the sole accreditor of all pharmacy schools for 100 years from CE. And from our perspective, we do ask for any activity that's going to be shown and put on for pharmacists and pharmacy technicians and other professionals, that the piece be disclosed whether there will be off-label use being talked about. And we are seeing an increase in more off-label use being discussed in activities. And we are also seeing that sometimes providers choose not to put that activity together and will not offer it to pharmacists if there is going to be off-label use.
I think this, did you have a question? Yeah.
I was just wondering if you knew how prevalent it was that doctors inform patients that they're prescribing them a drug for off-label use, and if you thought that encouraging doctors to inform patients that this drug where they were prescribing hadn't been tested to the same rigorous level as approved uses would affect the prevalence of off-label use.
I mean, that would get to my idea of having standards of care for off-label prescribing, but I wonder if our internist has a sense of that.
You know, when I was in practice, I knew nothing about a product label. You know, and because you're taught in your pharmacology class about what the drugs are useful for, the pros and the cons, but not the education, and it may change because now it's a long time ago, but the education is not linked to the label because what gets in the label is this ongoing negotiation between a drug company around a clinical trial and a regulatory authority, and the labels can be different from country to country because the local regulatory environments are different. So when I was out in practice, I didn't think about the label in that way. And then, you know, I went from that experience in a general medicine practice. We saw a lot of indigent patients, but also had a private practice. And then I went into drug safety. And I could not get over how much time was spent in a labeling meeting to finesse exactly what language goes in the label, because you're trying to address legal concerns, you're trying to make it medically accurate, trying to make sure you fulfill regulatory requirements, and then you need to make it useful for all these things. And then also to have a defensive documentation for ultimately for the viability concerns. But the whole concept of on-label, off-label, when I was in practice, it didn't even enter my thought process. And the only thing I can remember specifically was when Wellbutrin was an antidepressant or anti-anxiety medication. It became known that it was useful for smoking cessation, but at the time, you know, I had patients asking me to write Wellbutrin, but make the indication, the psychiatric indication, because they knew that their insurance company would pay for it that way, but they would never pay for tobacco cessation, because insurance companies won't pay for tobacco cessation. So, you know, there's a place there that probably is pretty close to what you're asking about, but there's the patients often want or need the off-label indication too, and to get to the point again about, you know, that it's very precise what the indication is that is approved. There's so many, especially with, you know, personalized medicine, which is a big topic at this meeting too. What may work in a general clinical trial setting is such a limited patient population. Most of your patients that you see would not have met the criteria to get into a clinical trial because they can't have heart disease, they can't have liver disease, so you rule out all of this stuff. But you know, you see everything when you're in practice.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know, and I don't think that the clinical interaction is the place where you're going to be able to discuss this on off label, because they are very dynamic things. And again, and I don't think that that's. Hopefully, you are what you were expressing before, the power sharing with between a client and a doctor. That's something that is going to address what are the pros and the cons, and that's going to be the basic discussion that hopefully every doctor is going to be having: what is in favor and what is against. And when you say something against, of course, you're going to mention all the side effects and all the things that you know of, but it's going to qualify just for that person in front of you. So in theory, I agree. In practice, I think that it's more difficult to deal with that.
I also think it's a hard, I mean, I think the number of physicians who are actually aware of what the evidence is behind their clinical practice is pretty low. I mean, the physicians do, and they prescribe what they believe to be correct based on their training and their experience, not necessarily based on the evidence. And, you know, if there's evidence, we found that, you know, 55% of the care in the United States is sort of evidence-based care. The rest of it is something else. So even if doctors did want to let their patients know what the science is and they had the time and the ability, I don't think that it would be effective just because they're not aware of the scientific background, or if there is a scientific background beyond their own experience and training as well.
I just want to mention that the this evidence-based, there is these evidence-based practice center, which are acute ones, and they have looked at off-label use. One from Oregon looked at off-label use of antipsychotics. Very good report. But we don't have, as you say, the doctors aren't aware of this, the public is not aware. In the UK, where they have this National Institute of Clinical Excellence, it seems that which makes decisions on the NHS, you know, everybody is aware of it, but there needs to be a way of raising that. It seems that there is this evidence base that people aren't aware of.
By the way, this is Bob, everyone, who's my co-chair for the APHA Pharmaceutical Interest Working Group. It's 10 o'clock. And I'm happy to stay. I don't know whether other people are for a while, but I want to thank the panelists. And also, I want to say that I think what we have that's coalesced across many section boundaries and also outside of APHA are people who are interested in these broad policy and legislative issues where we need public regulation or public investment in things like comparative effectiveness and academic detailing to physicians and other things that sort of change the way the whole system ticks. So we have better drug safety and we have access in places where access is an issue and cost control. So that's the sort of general value interest. It's not the science of the drugs that we're talking about in these group meetings. So it's nice to meet some of the people I haven't met before. And some of you who I have, and I hope that anybody who's interested in these issues will sort of stay in touch one way or another, whether you're at the next conference or you're not. But if you are going to be at the next conference, that would be great too. So thanks for everybody.